I'm Bob Adelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll talk to cartoonist Jeffrey Brown, best known for his Star Wars books, Vader's Little Princess, Darth Vader and Son, Goodnight Darth Vader, and the Jedi Academy series, as well as his work for McSweeney's and the Best American Comics. His latest project is Lucy and Andy Neanderthal, which is spun off of the Random House graphic novel series for kids, Comic Squad. Stick around. You cannot read Vader's Little Princess without ping-ponging between laughing out loud and wiping the occasional tear for how sweetly this artist can portray Darth Vader. It was probably about 2 years ago when my family gave me a copy of Vader's Little Princess by Jeffrey Brown for my birthday. I will admit that I thought it was a gag gift, a trifle, something that was an afterthought. The cover features Darth Vader participating in a tea party with Princess Leia and an Ewok, for crying out loud. Okay, then I started reading it. Oh my goodness, folks. I don't care how old you are, if you've ever seen a film in the original Star Wars trilogy, you will adore this book. Every page is a unique nugget of whimsy and delight that will have you laughing and crying as Brown looks at life with Leia from adolescence to teenage rebellion. And literally. The book has been proudly displayed on our living room coffee table ever since, always on the top of the pile. And I've since read the other titles in the series, including Darth Vader and Son, Darth Vader and Friends, and, of course, Goodnight, Darth Vader. I've wanted to have Brown as a guest here ever since, and publication of the second edition of the Random House graphic novel short story series for kids, Comic Squad, opened the door. Brown's latest series couldn't be more different from his venture with the children of Anakin Skywalker, and yet it isn't a stretch to recognize the parallels. In the story of Lucy and Andy Neanderthal, we enter the world of two cave children from a long-ago era, far, far away from the galaxy-scorching stories of Star Wars. But we again find ourselves immersed in the adventures of a clever, somewhat mischievous brother and sister, this time set against a backdrop where the most advanced technology is cooking soup inside animal skin. Now, Brown is one of several top contributors to Comic Squad 2, the theme of which is lunch. And Jeffrey Brown, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really glad to have you here. It's not often that I gush that much about somebody's work. But I'm telling you, I have read and reread, and any time if I'm like bummed out or something, I see that book sitting over there on the coffee table, and I'll go over and I'll pick it up for a few minutes and just kind of go through it. It's such a unique piece of work. I really like it. That's all.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, whose idea was it to jump completely out of the box on the Skywalker saga and put Luke and Leia in a home of sorts with their dad?
Yeah, you know, it actually started out as an idea for a Google Doodle. So Google, they normally have an internal team who does all the artwork or images for, the homepage images when there's a holiday or special occasion. But every once in a while, they'll bring in an outside artist. And I had met Ryan Germick, who runs the team. And he thought of me for this idea they had. They wanted to do something with an everyday father and son moment between Vader and Luke. And my autobiographical work had dealt with just awkward everyday moments. And he knew I was also a science fiction fan, and I was also a dad.
And a cat fan.
And so, my first immediate reaction was to think of Luke as 4 years old, because that's how old my son was. And so I did up a bunch of sketches, and in the end they decided not to use the idea. But I realized that Chronicle Books, who had published my cat books, had done a lot of work with Lucasfilm, and I thought maybe they'd be able to take the idea to Lucasfilm and see if they'd be interested in doing it. And so they did, and Lucasfilm was, and that became the first book, Darth Vader and Son.
It's amazing that Google actually had an idea for another huge project, I assume a huge project, certainly a great idea, and they walked away from it.
Yeah, well, at the time, I don't think any. I mean, even I think I did maybe a dozen sketches, dozen different ideas, most of which are in the book. But you know, it's hard to make that jump to see what it could become, and even, you know, finishing the first book, I had no idea that of exactly, you know, we had this idea that we could do a sequel with Leia and maybe it should do something different so that it's not all toddler jokes again, or you know, 4-year-old jokes. And it made sense to make her a teenager, and then you can get Han Solo in there. And but yeah, you know, it's hard to see where that's all going to go. I mean, before the first book came out, you know, we had no idea what the reaction would be. We thought, like, it'd probably do well just because it's Star Wars, but the response has been incredible to it, so.
It's such a unique idea unto itself. But also, what I got to go back to this. What I find fascinating here is that there are people, I believe, at Lucasfilm whose job is to come up with ideas to spin off products, right, and generate merchandise. And it didn't originate there. It originated at Google, which did not follow up on it. They had the idea. They gave it to you. And then you saw the potential in it. You went to Chronicle, and which fortunately had the Star Wars connection. Was it tough though to convince Lucasfilm that this was a good idea by that point?
No, I mean, so I think part of it too was you know, Lucasfilm was already on board with Google doing it, so they knew about the idea of doing it for Google. And to be fair, you know, there's lots of other factors involved with Google's decision not to use this particular idea. So, but yeah, once Chronicle took it to Lucasfilm, like my editor at Lucasfilm told it, and he was like, we knew right away that we wanted to do this. But, you know, it was, I think, 8 months or something before they finally came back with the approvals. So it wasn't difficult except for just this waiting to see, like, are they going to do it? Will they let me do it? Yeah, so I mean, I was also fortunate. Frank Parisi, who's at Lucasfilm now, but was also in between working at Lucasfilm when I pitched this idea, and now he was at Del Rey working on their books. But he was actually familiar with my older work also, so I think that helped too, because normally, yeah, Lucasfilm doesn't normally take external pitches. It's normally all originates with them, and or you know, sometimes with the relationships with licensees or licensors, they, you know, I think there's a little bit of room there, and I think that's where Chronicle managed to fit in, where, you know, Chronicle had done a lot with them that has been done really well, so.
And what was the timetable on this in terms of, I mean, there was quite a bit of upheaval just a few years ago at Lucasfilm in that George Lucas decided to sell to Disney. Was this deal consummated before the sale or after the sale?
Yeah, so Vader and Son was done and out, and Vader's Little Princess was signed, and the First Jedi Academy was done, but maybe not published yet, when Disney purchased Lucasfilm. So, in the end, there was a pause there after the Disney purchase, and we didn't know if there'd be another book after Vader's Little Princess, or if they'd let us do a second and third Jedi Academy. But in the end, we're able to do both of those things. So,
And with Disney stepping in to the situation, when you got this approved, and we won't spend all our time talking about Star Wars, I promise, but when you got this approved, Lucas was clearly ramping down, and that was part of the issue, is that he was, you know, didn't, you know, just kind of easing out of it. Then suddenly the property becomes hot again in Disney's hands. Has there been any interest from Disney in, you know, doing other things with this idea? It would seem like a natural for, you know, cartoons and
I mean,
merchandise.
they may have plans, but you know, it's, you know, that's like, it's a big company, and so there's, it's funny because I have a sense that, maybe some people have ideas for doing some things, and but there's so many different departments, and that, it has to go around. And so, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see like maybe a Jedi Academy cartoon would be a lot of fun, but no plans that I know of. So we'll see if I may wake up one morning with an email with some exciting news, but.
I would think that there would be a lot of parents who after reading, like as I did, Vader's Little Princess, they would think, boy, I'd love to be able to get my kid a little plushie of Leia
Oh yeah.
and Vader, and or I could see my kid waking up on Saturday morning watching the adventures of little Princess Leia and
Yeah.
so anyway, I was just curious. And what kind of rules and review did you have to go through for something like that?
It's pretty involved in a way, so there's approvals and feedback at every step from initial idea to finished art. So, with the Vader books, what I would do is come up with a sketchbook and fill it with 100, 150 ideas for each book, and then I would go through with my editor at Chronicle, and J.W. Rinzler was my editor at Lucasfilm, and everyone would kind of go through it and pick out, these are my favorites. These are the ones that maybe I would be good if we work on them a little, and these are the ones we don't like, and then we'd all lobby for if there's one that that I really liked that wasn't on either of their lists, and I would fight for it. And but for the most part, I mean, the vast majority, we're all on the same page. Like, these are the strongest ideas, and then John Rinzler was great about really giving just the right feedback on an idea, like, for me to go back and rethink it and take it a step up. And so once we had the ideas, then I would do full pencils, and those would get approved, and then the finished artwork, and that would get approved. And with Jedi Academy, it's the same thing, but I would have an outline, and then a rough draft, and then a second rough draft, and then the finished art. But for all the Star Wars work I've done, the process is actually, as involved as it is, it's been really smooth. Just I've never had something where they wanted me to like change things or put something in that didn't fit, and there's never been something that I really wanted in that they were just no. It was really like, we creatively, I think everyone was on the same page from the beginning, which really helped the experience.
I read your blog post at the Chronicle Books website about how you pitched some of the books and the road to publication. What interested me most was your decision not to reuse quotes or scenes from the movies, although you do sprinkle lots of Star Wars lingo and throughout the books.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not, I guess, so it's not reusing quotes from the movies, but reusing quotes that I've used in other books. So
Oh, I didn't
if I
get
used
that.
a,
Okay.
yeah, so if I used a quote in Vader and Son, even though like that would be the perfect quote for another idea, I didn't want to ever try and use the same quote twice. I think it maybe happens once or twice, but for the most part, I didn't want to overuse, any of the quotes.
Yeah, but it just feels like if you could buy the fact that Darth Vader lived at home with Luke and Leia, for example, okay, well, I don't know, it just all flows. Of course, there's some really funny stuff. I don't want to give any gags away. There's really funny stuff with the Death Star, and you did what to my, I mean, it's just great. Anyway, how different were the various Star Wars books from your previous comics and cartoons in terms of the amount of work? It seems like the style is quite different. And then, well, let's start with that. It's quite different, I'm guess.
I mean, I in a way they're very different. The the artwork for Vader and Son, and its sequels was much lusher and fuller than anything I'd done previously. My initial comics were autobiographical and very stripped down in a very expressive kind of scratchy style. But at the same time, I think, I try to keep a lot of that in the books. So, I try to put a lot of feeling into it. And so in a way, stylistically, you can look at my self-published book from 2000, Clumsy, and then you can look at Darth Vader and Son, and they look very different. But if you look at everything in between, it all follows, I think. And also, Vader and Son, even though it's Star Wars, is very autobiographical. It's, it's my feelings and experiences as a parent, and Jedi Academy too. It's tapping into, my memories and thoughts about middle school and high school, and so, ultimately, I think that's the key thread that runs through all these different works, is that it's coming from a very personal place, and also just, having grown up loving Star Wars, it's that's also very personal. So, but yeah, and I think, as the more work I do, I like to think that I get better at it. So, I would hope that each book is different in a way too, that it stands alone. So, like the book that I'm doing now, Lucy and Andy, there's a lot of similarities to how I did Jedi Academy and how it looks visually, but it's also very different.
Yeah, I mean, the style of it is very different. As I mentioned in the introduction, you have a young boy and girl, a brother and sister, and they are not perfectly behaved at all times. They seem to, which is good. I mean, you wouldn't, it's going to be kind of dull if they were. It's interesting. And the other thing, now, Lucy, okay, so let's switch to, we'll start talking, we'll leave Luke and Leia behind now, and let's talk about Lucy and Andy, Neanderthal. I'm guessing, and I did not read about one way or the other, but I'm guessing that she has the name Lucy because of a rather famous Neanderthal derivation. Is that on target?
Yeah, I mean, so the original Lucy wasn't a Neanderthal skeleton, but it was oh, now I should know this. It's a different human ancestor species, and so my idea was like she's named after her great 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 grandmother.
Got it. And Andy?
And then Andy was just, I just. Once I had Lucy, then the idea was, it just seemed to come together, and I liked the idea of the funny alliteration of Andy Neanderthal, so
Okay.
which is kind of a tongue twister, but there's something about it that I really liked. So once I those names just kind of, and then having the Y at the end of both, and it just seemed to fit together.
And all of the names, or most all of the names, I think, in the comic, as I read in Comic Squad, were right out of any American neighborhood today. I mean, Margaret, Daryl, Phil. Why go with this kind of familiar naming as opposed to what we think of, like ancient, like
Like
want to call?
Og and
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Luke.
Exactly.
Well, because one of the things that I wanted to do with these books was take away that kind of alienation of things. So for Lucy and Andy, or for ancient Neanderthals, whatever their names were, they weren't unusual names to them. So I wanted there to be a sense like, that these aren't such different, like these relationships aren't so different than our own, and that they don't have the technology and they don't know about things that we know about now, but as as people, like they're not some strange, weird creature.
Right. They're people. Right. I mean, that's the idea, that they're just people. That if you're a kid reading this, you can relate to it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and for kids to be able to relate to it too, that's a big part of it. And you know, aside from making the main characters like kids.
So. Is the and this I don't know. There's the adventure of, there's Lucy and Andy in this comic squad lunch, the second in the comic squad book. Was there a previous? Is this their first appearance overall, or did they appeared elsewhere?
That's their first appearance. So, yeah, so bag that up for your comic collection and save it.
Oh, my God. I think I may have bent the spine. Oh, no. Yeah. I'll have to get another one.
That's okay. That means you read it. So.
It's true. Yeah, I did read it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny. Lucy and Andy actually started as a pitch for a TV cartoon that and it was a little bit different form and – but it was always sitting there in the back of my mind as something I'd like to do someday. And then I realized like it would be really fun to do as a book. And, so the story that's in Comic Squad was part of the first draft of the first book. And then as the first book changed, that story kind of wasn't necessary. And then, but kind of fit perfectly for Comic Squad because it's about eating lunch. So, then I just, that was actually the first story that I finished, too. And then,
would you be comfortable maybe showing us what maybe Lucy looks like, maybe drawing Lucy for us? And maybe I was just thinking about this. Could you draw Lucy and Leia side by side so people can see the difference?
Yeah, let's see here. I can rearrange things.
All right. Oh, that'll be great. Yep. So, we can see the board perfectly.
Yeah. Now the question is, can I draw at this angle?
This is where the professionalism comes through.
Here, let me see. I'm gonna actually get a bigger pen.
All right. It's good too because we're getting a good view of your what I assume to be your office and studio.
Yeah. So this is my little studio. I usually work just on a lap board. The Lucy and Andy pages and the Jedi Academy pages were just drawn on just Bristol.
That size?
This size. So I usually draw at print size or thereabouts. So the Darth Vader books are actually drawn a little bit smaller than print size.
Wow.
And I think one of the reasons I like that is I think there's an important relationship to the reading experience of how big something is to in relationship to you as a reader. And so the Darth Vader books are a very particular size, and I wanted to be able to know what that was as I was drawing it, as opposed to drawing something like traditionally comics are drawn really big and then shrunk down. And but I just like to be able to see it at size as I'm working on it. So
okay.
Yeah, so I'll draw. Leia just has. Oh wait, hold on. I'm gonna start over.
It's okay.
That's not how I start drawing Leia. Leia always starts with one of her buns.
Don't we all?
And then.
It's always interesting to see how characters that we look at all the time, they can be simplified down to certain shapes.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'll do some extra little Star Wars here, but Leia, so Luke has the same head shape because, you know, they're twins, of course.
Of course, yeah.
And Luke's, the way I draw Luke actually comes from how I draw my son Oscar. Although now he's 9, so I can't really draw him as young looking. But Oscar is basically the same as Luke. I don't know if this is coming out, hopefully, but with a different slightly different, less 70s hairstyle. Oh, Luke and Oscar are just, they're just looking progressively less and less happy. And then, so for Lucy and Andy, so one of the things about the Neanderthals is they did have some physiological differences, and one of the advantages to comics is you can kind of take advantage of how comics play with reality. So an example in Star Wars is, you know, Darth Vader's helmet is static, you know, it doesn't really move, but
right. But
I can use his helmet to make him have various expressions. So here he's kind of angry, but you know, I can change his helmet to make him sad or confused. That's cross-eyed, I guess.
I think the sad and confused Vader is what we see in what's left of his helmet in The Force Awakens.
Yeah, that's very... He's very confused at that point. And so with Lucy and Andy, one of the things about Neanderthals is they don't really have chins. So Lucy and Andy's chins always kind of go like that.
I'd just like to say my grandmother didn't have a chin either.
Well,
what does that say? Never mind.
Well, we do all, most of us have some Neanderthal DNA. So
there she is.
Nice.
What holds her ponytail in place, by the way?
Well,
sorry.
I think it's a suspension of disbelief.
Oh, that's what holds it in place.
No, you know, I do try to make the books as factually accurate as possible, but you know, I also try to play with things a little, but you know, they did have string either, you know, so these books are taking place 40,000 years ago, and that's, I think maybe 50,000 years ago is when they have the first evidence of plant fibers being twisted together to make a kind of string, and then it's also theorized that they would use animal ligaments. Would also make strings, so she might just have some, you know, mammoth intestines tied around there.
I was just making a joke. Okay. You didn't have to get all scientific, but thank you. That was good.
They go together.
Yeah.
They go together. Another place that I fiddle with things, so I do have, this is perhaps the most inaccurate thing in the book on many levels. So pet cats didn't exist 40,000 years ago. We didn't have domesticated cats until
the Flintstones,
6,000 years ago or something.
Well, not until the Flintstones, anyway.
But Lucy and Andy have a pet cat named Tiny. It was a scimitar cat, so he's got the little scimitar teeth, and he's also really tiny. He's the size of a house cat, even though scimitar cats were much bigger. So but you know, I do have a little section in the back of the book where I kind of explain some of the things that you might think that I just made up for purposes of the story but are actually true, and then other things that I did make up just because, like, I just wanted to have a little more fun drawing. So,
well, a lot of people will think that you made up the fact that anything happened 40,000 years ago when the Earth didn't exist then. So,
yeah, that's a whole other book series.
That's going to cost you a whole audience right there. So the cat, but the cat is not in the Comic Squad story though, right? I don't remember seeing the cat.
He shows up in like a couple panels.
Okay. But he's not real prominent in the story.
No.
All right, then I apologize that I missed it, but I wasn't looking for it either at the time. So
yeah.
All right. Well, that's very cool. Thank you for sharing that. Now, one of the things I want to ask you about is you are a product of an art school. You went to the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, right? How did that? I assume to be an art student, you were already wanting to be an artist in high school. But how did the art school experience affect your style, your direction, and your intent?
Well, I mean, so I went to, just a liberal arts college in Michigan for undergrad, and then I had 3 years after that where I was just painting and making art and making, like, capital A art, fine art, thinking that, I was going to make these amazing paintings that would be in a gallery in New York someday, or and but I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan after college, just working, doing that, and not really showing anyone, and also just felt like I wasn't really pushing it where I wanted it to go, and it wasn't really going anywhere. So I figured I one needed some kind of change, and then I also thought I needed to find a different environment that would kind of push my art a little more. And so that's came to Chicago in 2000 to attend the School of the Art Institute. And it was while I was there that, the paintings still weren't working. They still weren't expressing the ideas that I wanted them to. And at the end of my first year, I was kind of frustrated, and the faculty were kind of like frustrated. They were, and it was just kind of just to clear my head and just have a complete change of pace. I thought I would, I always had fun drawing comics when I was a kid, so I was going to draw a comic. And there's a lot of work that you see and are exposed to in art school that's very conceptual in nature. And so I thought I'll make my comic as the exact opposite of that as possible. I'll just make it just this extremely personal autobiographical story about a long distance relationship. And so that was my first book, Clumsy. And it's just these little 1 to 2 page little snippets, moments of life, just tiny moments and everyday things. And when I finished that, I realized that, maybe I'm just not a painter in the end. And maybe this is a place where I can really express things in a way that does get across to people and is also just more fulfilling for me creatively. And
So was the
that's
art
kind
school
of where.
experience, was it valuable to you in the end? If it maybe
Oh,
it was,
definitely,
okay.
definitely. I mean, I think you get what you get out of it, what you put into it, and I feel like the first part of being there was a lot of hitting my head against the wall because I was still kind of trying the same things. But you then the different faculty having different responses and pushing you, trying to push you in different directions, and I ended up going, I think, in a direction that no one was trying to push me, and I didn't expect to go myself. But I don't know if I would have gotten to the same place without being there and having those all those different influences.
Were there any fellow students whose work we might know now that you went to school with? Not to put you on the spot. Sorry.
Not that I can think of, but I mean, it's also like, I kind of went to such a different world.
Right.
Like, I just went to this world of comics. I guess one student that was there, who I didn't really meet him till after art school, is Anders Nilsson, another cartoonist. He did a book called Big Questions. It's probably his most well-known work, but he was at the School of the Art Institute while I was there, and then shortly after I left, Lily Carré was at the school, and she's pretty well known in comic circles. So, and there's other people from the comics community that came out of there. But I think there are people doing the fine art that are out there, but it's just like I just went to such a different place
Oh, that's absolutely
afterwards.
fine.
So.
Well, let me ask you this. Who are some of your cartooning heroes? I mean, for example, if appropriate, who did you want to be? Obviously, you were doing fine art, you were painting before you went to the Institute. I don't know if you had the strong interest. I know you were a big Star Wars fan, but who did you want to be when you grew up? What it doesn't have to be in comics, obviously.
I mean, there's a few different artists. I mean, one artist who kind of is more of from the fine art world is Charlotte Solomon, who did a series of gouaches called Life or Theater, and it was kind of a mix of image and text and very expressionistic, and like German Austrian expressionism was a big influence on me, and that idea of just kind of trying to imbue emotion in the lines that you're drawing. And so her work is like was something that I was really inspired by and also influenced by, I think. In comics, there's a lot of cartoonists. I think one of the artists that kind of clicked with me in terms of going back to comics was Chris Ware, and I won't go into the stories. You can I have a book called Funny Misshapen Body that kind of tells about art school and how I and about meeting Chris Ware and kind of having these key moments. But even aside from actually having gotten to meet him here in Chicago, but his work and seeing what he was doing with comics was a big inspiration. Julie Doucet is another artist. She's a Canadian cartoonist, although she doesn't do comics so much anymore, but her comics were a big part of my interest in doing autobiographical comics and what I was trying to do with them.
Do you see yourself returning to the autobiographical comics in the future? You've kind of ventured away and you've done.
I mean, I did the last book I did was a few years ago, and it's called A Matter of Life, and that was about fatherhood and I guess religion, but in the sense that my dad was a minister, and so it's just kind of just thinking about these questions and without knowing the answers. And after that book, that was the last kind of book that was really kind of bothering me to do. Like it was the one that I was really compelled to do. So for now, I mean, I'm sure I'll do more at some point, but for now, I feel like I've covered most of the territory that I was really itching to do, and there's other things that I would like to maybe tackle, but I'm not ready to. And the one thing I do want to do is a book that I did a mini comic called Process that was just kind of a short comic about how I work, and I want to do an expanded version of that and fill it with anecdotes about going to comic conventions and things that happen, and mixed with like this kind of art instruction manual side of things.
Well, I imagine having a. I think you said your son is 9. Yeah. So you've got a good 10 years of good material ahead of you that you can store up for a while. And then dealing with comics fans, on the other hand, there's always going to be something fresh and unwashed there to deal with. Just a couple more questions. We'll let you get through, get out of here. Have you developed any rules for yourself to follow in creating, like cartoons for or the comics for children, let's say? Is there and I know from my experience with children's books, they talk about there's so many words in a book for a certain age, and then, you know, you jump up in age, there's more
Yeah.
words. Have you created any rules?
No, I'm really bad at that. Like I kind of just write without thinking about that too much. And so, I mean, part of that is the Vader books were intended for adults, but kids love them so much. Like that never expected that kind of response. And or in hindsight, it seems obvious, but and so when I went to write Jedi Academy, I just kind of approached it the same way. Like, you know, I'm just telling these stories. You know, there's a lot of little bits that are kind of twisted from my own experiences in middle school, and then just, you know, kind of changing them a little and putting them in the Star Wars universe. And then I just really left it up to my editors to kind of pull me back when it was, you know, something that they thought would go over kids' heads. But you know, so Lucy and Annie too has been, that one's been a bit of a challenge in terms of the information, and you know, trying to get the information as accurate as possible, but also something that kids can understand, and where that line is, where it's, you know, useful information or meaningful, but still something that they'll be able to latch on to in the middle of an, you know, a book that's a humorous book.
I like the diagram you did explaining how they made soup, for example. You know, and
Yeah.
you know they could do it in the animal skin. That was it. I never would have thought of that. I mean, you know, it was just really interesting and good the way you explained it. And then you also at the I shouldn't talk about the end, but you do put things in context a bit by the end of
Yeah.
the story. And I think
Yeah,
that
well, I mean,
for the kids.
we can say there's a, I have two paleontologist characters, and they show up at the, in the book, in the first book or the full books, they show up at the end of chapters for a page or two and kind of talk about, you know, how we know different things, you know, the, whether it's, you know, what evidence we found about that they eat this or that, or how they make their stone tools and things.
It's a great device. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Okay, so let's wrap up with bringing things all the way around. I got to ask what you thought of Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens. You're in that universe. What did you think?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, I have some minor quibbles with it. mostly because I think I've, like, just the more storytelling I deal with, especially having done some TV and film stuff now, you know, I'm like more aware of that, those processes. And so then I can see where, like, oh, they didn't, there, this character wasn't in another scene because they needed to do this. And you know, I like, and I can understand why they did it, but then it's still frustrating. Like, well, why even have that character do that, or why do this? But you know, I thought, but overall, you know, I just went and just, you know, I just had fun just watching it. It was nice to also watch a Star Wars film for the first time in a while, where I wasn't watching it as part of work, which is,
Well, but see, that's what I wanted to ask you, because when I saw it the second time, I thought of you, and I thought of you sitting there going, you know, Finn and Rey,
I tried. I tried to
there's some
not.
childhood stories there to be
Yeah, I
mined.
tried to not think about any of that at all. I, you know, and even now too, like, you know, I'm working on the Neanderthal series, so I'm taking a little break from Star Wars, and you know, now I can go back and I'm watching the original movies with my kids, and being able to just, you know, just really enjoy them again, instead of, you know, just pausing frame by frame for drawing reference, or watching them again and again, trying to find the right quotes to or the right scenes or the right, you know, characters to turn into something for the book. So,
But it had to
yeah.
cross your mind that Ray and Finn particularly would fit in another series of these types of
Yeah,
books.
yeah. And I've done the kids, and so, you know, one thing to do would be, you know, the grandparents and the older parents. So, you know,
I mean, I could see Finn in Stormtrooper Academy.
yeah,
Right?
there you
With,
go.
you know, number 87, whatever his number was. Anyway, last question. Have you optioned any of your work at this point to Hollywood, that kind of thing? Is there anything out there?
I mean, so I, you know, the Star Wars work is all controlled by Disney, so it's up to them if they want to let anything happen with it. Other than that, you know, I did co-write a film called Save the Date, that not a kid's film. Before you go out and rent that for your kids, please don't. And you know, that came out of not optioning my autobiographical books, which I decided that I really wanted to keep all that work as just books. And if I was going to do anything with film and TV, it was going to be, you know, something new and could be in the same vein, but didn't draw from a particular story. And yeah, other than that, you know, I have a Transformers parody called Incredible Change Bots that was, it made it to being optioned, but then nothing ever happened with it. And that's one that would be a fun cartoon to work on, I think, too.
Okay, very good. Well, folks, listen, you can find cartoonist Jeffrey Brown's latest work, Lucy and Andy Neanderthal, in the children's graphic novel anthology series. I don't know how else to describe that. Comic Squad 2, Lunch. And the first book in that series we expect will be out in August 2016. So probably summertime you'll be able to pre-order it on Amazon. And of course you can also get his many Star Wars collections and earlier works pretty much wherever you typically get books, or you can order them right now, right here at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching at MrMedia.com, below the video you'll see the images of the covers of several of his books. You can just click on it, take it to Amazon right now, and you can order it instantly. And I understand they can get it to you via drone in about 30 minutes or less, or it's free. Now, don't quote me on that. That may not be correct. You may have to wait a day or two. Jeffrey, what about a website? Where do you want to send people to find out more?
Yeah, so I have a website that's very utilitarian and not updated often. It's jeffreybrowncomics.com, and updated only slightly more often. In fact, I think it's been a few months since I've had a chance to go do anything in it. But jeffreybrowncomics.blogspot.com, I usually have try to post at the very least updates on appearances and signings and new books coming out. So, probably sometime in February, I'll probably update that.
What about social
That new
media?
post.
Are you on Twitter or Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
You know, I joined Twitter and I haven't tweeted yet. I'm waiting. I'm gonna wait.
Okay.
I'm not on Facebook.
All right. All right.
I feel like that's a rabbit hole that I should probably avoid.
Probably true. Also, on the other hand, with a name like Jeffrey Brown, it could take people years to find you.
Yeah.
You know, that's
I don't know. There's some resourceful people out there.
Well, that's true. And if you had told us that you were on there, people would start looking immediately now. Well, listen, Jeffrey Brown, it was I told you at the top how much I enjoyed Vader's Little Princess. It just saying it out loud still brings a smile to my face. Good luck with the rest of your work, the upcoming stuff,
Thank
and
you.
thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Intermedia is recorded live before a studio audience full of Gungans from the planet Naboo who hope that Jar Jar Binks didn't make it impossible for them to be featured in a future Jeffrey Brown book in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.